tap your little toes. Oh, oh, I wanna know.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Thinking Pilates podcast. I am here with my beautiful, sweet, and thoughtful co-host, Deborah Colway. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Chantel.
It is a very exciting episode, although I find that I say that almost every time, but it really is this time because we have two special guests joining us to carry on a conversation that Deborah and I started last episode about missed opportunities, and perhaps more appropriately it would have been called not missing opportunities, right? How to grab, how to open and see opportunities in our teaching. So we're joined today with two teachers from the Skillful Teaching Mentoring Program, and I'm honored to have you both here. Thank you for your time. Julie Lanoka and Pam Hess. Julie is here in Sacramento with me, and we met last summer, and it's been a pleasure working with her over the last 10 months or so. And Pam Hess, I recently met in Indiana early in the year during a whirlwind tour of workshops, which was so awesome. Just very, very excited to have you in our program and on the call today. Ladies, I'm going to let you introduce yourselves so we can move into this conversation with a little bit of a sense of who you are and where you're coming from. So Julie, would you mind starting us off?
Sure. My name is Julie Lanoka, and I came to Pilates as a student. I was working at a kitchen design business in Concord, New Hampshire, and there's not a lot of Pilates there, but I was working in a pretty tense environment, and my boss actually started paying for us to go to Pilates because of all the muscle tension that we had in the work that we did. And I just found it hugely helpful in my fixing my migraines because I was able to lose a lot of tension in my traps and stuff. And my horseback riding also improved dramatically. So, you know, very early on, I became very interested in this method of exercise. And it was working on my body in a way that I had never experienced before. And the teacher I was working with at the time, Linda Oakes, she asked me if I would like to become a teacher and teach in her studio. And she had done all her training in New York. So I started going to New York with her and on my own and started doing Linda Farrell's, Linda Fit Pilates. She does a mat training class, and she was a student of Romana's. And then I also went to Connected, which is another studio in New York, and their focus is very rehab-oriented. I think the studio is owned by a physician and a physical therapist, but they run a wonderful anatomy program called FAMI. That's a four-day anatomy program at Mount Sinai Hospital that I urge everyone to try to go to because it's 4 days at Mount Sinai in their anatomy lab with their anatomy instructors. So I got this wonderful background in anatomy and therapeutic Pilates and mostly contemporary Pilates until I moved to Sacramento. And when I moved to Sacramento about almost 3 years ago now, I started kind of reintroducing myself to some training through the balanced body education model. And just have been finding that wonderfully expansive addition to my training. I hadn't really done a lot of training on reformer before, so I'm sort of being introduced to the equipment in a new way. And I've just found that Northern California is a wonderful resource for lots of teachers. I work with a guy named James Crater. I work out at his studio. And here in Sacramento, I work at Humani, which is another balanced body studio. And I go to San Francisco and take classes at different studios there. So I feel like my exposure to Pilates has been pretty broad, and it's very exciting.
And it's really such a gift to have you with us today, Julie, because I think you offer a unique perspective as a new teacher, as a very curious and diligent thinker. And just want to share that the work Julie has been observing and doing some work, and correct me, Julie, if I'm wrong, but with a man who is a quadriplegic.
Yeah, no, quadriplegic. So he does not have use of his hands. His injury is at C4. And, he is in a Pilates program down in Lafayette at the Absolute Center. But he lives here in Sacramento. So he also works with James, mm-hmm. and I volunteer and do some work with him mm-hmm. once a week, trying to help him specifically get some hand function back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then Julie is also working on kind of a long-term vision of bringing movement, and she's also a writer, and bringing movement and writing to
specifically women who've been sex trafficked. You know, I think that it's a huge problem in our country that people don't really know about, and the trauma that's happens from having that horrible experience mm-hmm. is really deep, and mm-hmm. I'm very interested in how the brain and the body work together to mm-hmm. heal from trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Wonderful. Yeah. So all really important things, I think, to kind of frame our conversation. So thank you for taking the time to introduce yourself with such depth. I appreciate it. Pam, how about you?
Sure. So my name is Pam Hess, and I actually recently moved to Indianapolis last July from Gainesville, Florida, which is where I started my Pilates path and my journey there. I was introduced to the Pilates realm essentially through a gym, a fitness club, and thought it was really cool because I love fitness and I was a mom of two and wanted to start kind of doing something on my own but not overcommit so I could still be a mama and be able to help raise my kids. So weekend warrior workshops of a Pilates reformer education. And I was a Pilates instructor. I thought I was really cool. Well, I soon began to realize there was more to this. And I just intuitively knew there was something deeper. I didn't get this. I didn't feel comfortable. I actually didn't feel like I was safe to teach. So I started investing a little bit more of my time and effort in the community where I lived in Gainesville and found a wonderful studio called Evolve Pilates. And truly is the best kept secret in that little town, that college town, and started taking classes and knew immediately, holy cow, I was in the wrong place. You know, over there, I needed to get this information because it just was like a totally different experience. And so it drove my passion because I was a teacher and I have this compassion for people and I want to help people. It's just the way the gifts that I've been given. That I started investing a little bit more effort into how do I become a better, student, as well as how do I become this teacher that I'm envisioning myself as. And they actually have a wonderful Pilates comprehensive curriculum that they train people, and it's very small, but it's well written. And I went through their little schooling and did great. Didn't know exactly what I couldn't believe I had gone through that weekend and then had gone through almost a year of training. And then sat for the PMA and felt confident enough to, okay, well, let's go ahead and make this all happen. And started building my little practice there and on a part-time basis. One of the things that I absolutely have always loved was the aha moment that I started seeing in my clients when they got sort of that connection, that mind-body connection, and that to me was what has always kept driving me back to the mat or the reformer or the Cadillac, is how can I help these people understand that this movement applies to their life in so many levels, and because that's how I saw it personally. I could finish triathlons and continue with my running because I can do, because the Pilates, it prevented me from injury majority of the time. I mean, still, everyone's probably to have some bumps in the road, but I know that it has helped me sustain overall a healthy, functional body. Still working on it, and will always and forever will, and know that. And that's what I keep telling my clients. And this is a life. This is a lifestyle that you need to choose to, you know, dedicate yourself to. So through our move, it has allowed me coming up here to kind of hit the reset button, and my path crossed with Gentile, and I really was at a point in my little teaching career, I guess, that I wanted to take this to a different path where I could make it more of a healing path and really focus on why am I teaching this. And I'm so grateful to you, Gentile, and the mentorship program that has helped me just hone in on my purpose. And that's what I'm pretty fired up about right now in my current teaching position, is that I have identified my purpose, and it may change, but at least I know where I'm going. Mm-hmm. Because there for a while, I just taught, but I didn't understand why I was really teaching. And that's the part where I'm at, and I'm excited about moving forward with that, because I know there's going to be some definition and some direction that's going to lead to some great opportunities for me here in this community that is a very yoga-heavy community. So I feel like I could help bring some, just some more, education to the community about what Pilates is. Not that yoga is bad, it's just, I think of it kind of like peanut butter and jelly. It's sort of, you need both, this is a very green community, and I'm excited about being in a new environment to, share my purpose and hopefully help people move better here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're also trained in gyrotonics, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I am currently. I'm almost finished. I'm in my apprenticeship and had to take a little detour with that since my move. I have found a wonderful master instructor over in Cincinnati. I've been working with her. So hopefully in the fall I'll be done with that, and which has been great because I think it's been a nice complement to my Pilates practice and understanding bone rhythm and spinal movement and where does this all come from. And it's just enriched my practice.
It's so great. When I met Pam, what we were working on, I had presented an extension workshop in Indiana, and she had missed it, but we did a lot of the work in our one-on-one, and it was so great. It was just like one of those perfect moments, which I think is it's a defining moment for me in terms of knowing you, Pam, because we were working on this, this kind of pattern of things, and moving the sacrum and moving the pelvis and squatting and all leading to improving back bending. And we went through this whole process of, intentional process of trying to get the body organized in a better and better and better way. And at the end, when we did kind of our last check-in, I remember, and we've got it on video, Pam, I remember she went into a low swan prep and goes up and up and up and just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. And she turns to me, she goes, "What the heck?" And it was just like, it was just a defining moment in like, oh my gosh, this woman is so curious and excited. There was just like this innocent, exuberance. And I've continued to experience that with you and really appreciate that about your perspective. I think it, again, frames this conversation that we're about to have. So let's get to it, shall we? So what we're talking about specifically is about discernment. So the process of discerning for ourselves how to teach, what perspective to teach from, talking about our purpose, as Pam has mentioned, the why for teaching, and our priorities in terms of what we want our students to achieve. So that's the macro view. That's the larger view that we hold as teachers, and hopefully we're holding that view with clarity and in a very explicit way, although I don't think that's always happening. Hopefully this conversation will bring that to light for many of you who are listening. The macro view is something along the lines of how we can, as teachers, be open to what's in front of us without just repeating what we've heard before from our teachers. I think this is really the jumping off point, Deborah, from our last conversation about missed opportunities. So it's like there's a moment or a time when we can begin to ask ourselves why we're doing something the way that we're doing it, and allow our own experience and knowledge to dictate the decisions that we make in teaching and infuse our understanding of the body, as opposed to just continuing to unconsciously or not mimic the teachers that have imparted their knowledge upon us. And so I think before we jump in, well, actually, let me just ask you, Deborah, if you have anything you want to add to where we're going today.
Well, I've been taking notes while I'm listening to everybody talk, and it's very inspiring, by the way, Pam and Julie, listening to both of you. And it makes me think how far we've all come in our industry to even be having this conversation, because, and to have such richness already, you know, before we've even gotten into the questions. Because it's kind of like, I can remember a time when we didn't really talk about these things. I mean, there wasn't a question of whether to teach what you, we weren't encouraged particularly to explore our own experience all that much. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of just really happy right now listening to the two of you, and just realizing that this whole next generation of teachers coming up, it's almost like, how do I say this, from a, there's a richness and a fullness of, like, the intention of knowing ourselves and being with people in a different way, you know, kind of starting to break down that wall between teacher and student a little bit, or teacher and client, you know. And that's the feeling that I'm getting from listening to this. And so I just wanted to say that I have questions to ask both of you once we start the question part. But I mean, I don't know if you realize that in a way, in your own introductions, you touched on many of the topics or the points that Chantel and I have been talking about. So it's in the air, and it's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Deborah. You know, let's start with just a question, which is like this. Is there a moment that you can recall beginning to question what you were taught? If you can think of a moment where you recognize, like, oh, this is so interesting, I think I'm going to say it a different way. I think I'm going to tweak it a little. I think I'm going to change the focus. I'm going to change the breath, because that's what my experience tells me, that's what this body tells me, that's what my own intuition tells me. And how fascinating that it's different than what, one, I've been doing, and two, I've been told how to do the thing. So can you recall a moment where there was an awareness? That's the question. I think let's just stop there. I could add on a second part, but I think let's just start there. So I'm going to start with Pam. What do you think about that?
You know, I knew you would ask me. It's funny because I have. And I think one of the things, and I'll be very specific about it, but it's length. When I started realizing if I could cue length, you know, and because I feel like there's always this hold, and there's always this connect, and da-da-da-da, you know, I always felt like that was what was told to me, you got to connect this, you got to pull this, you got to da-da-da, and it's like, as soon as I said, okay, I want you to get a little taller, or I want you to feel how you can really push those feet into the floor and really lengthen the head up to the sky, all of a sudden, it changed. Or see if you can broaten the collarbones a little wider. And I think as soon as I started cueing length in my clients, there is a sense of freedom. And maybe perhaps some release, you know, that I saw with them. And also within myself. Because then I felt like, holy cow, they're going to be okay, and I'm giving them sort of permission to move and not feeling so constricted. And I think this is where a little bit of gyrotonic has helped me kind of be okay to move in some sense with control. But I really feel like that's kind of what's happened, and it's liberating to see that. And like I said, for both the client and myself, and I like the way it makes me feel, and I know that it makes them feel good because then it makes them move better. So I don't know. I hope that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. So my question to that, just the piggyback, would be, is that different than what you were taught? Do you feel like that was an acknowledgement of your own experience and intuition, and you really felt like you were infusing your teaching with this level of, like, I would call that discerning, if it were like, oh, this is a piece I want to focus on. I want to make this a priority, whereas perhaps that was not focused on or made a priority in the same kind of way. Like, where you feel like you, I'm just having this, like, of maybe feeling just a little bit like a little woo-woo this evening, but like, like a flower unfurling one petal. It's like, here I am. I am a teacher in and of myself, unique and individual, and this is how I'm going to express myself now. This is my priority. This is what I feel like is important. So do you feel like it was something that came from your training, or something that you really moved into based on some other personal interior experience?
I think it's the latter, because I think through my training, and I was just trying to remember, you know, is that there was so much, instruction with regards to placement of the body and then movement once you were there a certain way. So I completely get the idea of good instruction and getting people to understand how, you know, how the exercise is supposed to go. But I felt like it was too, when I was taught initially, too much restriction there. And very rote. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
So, you know, and so when I started cueing length and finding space and then move, you know, that I think it's helped, you know? And it's only because I've had to experience that personally. And then I started thinking, well, maybe that's kind of what they're feeling. And then to kind of, you know, sharing that with people that need it. Because, you know, and then there's some people who probably need to be reeled in a little bit too, because they maybe moved a little too much. So.
Right.
But yeah.
Great. Thank you. Deborah, do you have any clarifying question or anything for Pam?
Well, I'm glad I appreciate the answer. The idea of, setting the body up first, being very clear about setting the body and then moving as if they're separate. I have to watch out that I don't just start talking right now. Because I think that's an amazing distinction. And I'm just going to say thank you for that. Because, yes, and I don't think I have any more questions regarding that.
Yeah, let's hold on to that, though, Deborah, because I think that is a really beautiful example of being discerning, of being able to acknowledge or recognize on some level, you know, in this spectrum of conscious to unconscious, you know, discernment between the difference, right? Some intuitive knowing on Pam's part to know that there is a difference between move, you know, arrange and then move versus just move. So let's, I would love to come back to that. Somebody's got some jazz music playing in the background.
Is that okay? My husband's playing saxophone.
No, I love it.
I came upstairs.
It's fantastic. We were like, we're being okay. Serenaded.
Okay.
I love it. I love it.
I was a little away, but the house is small.
No, I love it.
I like having a soundtrack.
No, it's fantastic. I forgot your husband was a musician, Deborah. I missed him that night when we were there last summer.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, Julie, what do you think about this question?
Well, I mean, it's so fascinating. It's just, you know, I think that I agree with Pam in the sense that while the cue to lengthen the spine is a cue that's, you know, used fairly often, I think that I'm not sure that it is emphasized enough in the actual training. And and it's the one that resonates with me the most. Like when I feel like I don't know where to go with somebody, I always feel like I can go back to, well, lengthen your spine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's almost always a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in terms of an aha moment of, okay, this is different, I feel differently than what I learned, I wouldn't say it was one thing, but I think that I have kind of felt like I wonder about the emphasis on flexion in a lot of the classical work, because, you know, I think part of my experience was based on one of the first students I had, and I had her twice a week for about 2 years as a one-on-one student. She had severe osteoporosis, mm-hmm. so we could do no flexion mm-hmm. at all, and she was a very fragile person. So I had to really think hard about coming up with lots of different ways to keep her moving in different planes and not have her flex at all. And, you know, just looking at the bodies in the world that are walking around out there right now, including, you know, my 25-year-old son and his fiance, I mean, everybody is so hunched forward. And mm-hmm. I just feel like maybe there should be more emphasis on extension work and, you know, can we strengthen the abdominals and the back by doing more, like, you know, pulling straps rather than hundreds curve, you mm-hmm. know, in flexion, like mm-hmm. in super flexion. So that's kind of something I've been thinking about a lot when I'm working out myself and when I'm watching other people work out is, you know, the method works really well. But I think bodies have changed a lot since Joseph Pilates, you know, created this work. And I just wonder how that might be reflected in the method.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what I want to say.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it starts to pull back a little bit. I think, you know, from Pam's experience of being a very deep micro perspective, to this starts to pull back just a little bit, I think, in examining what the method is doing, right? How we're utilizing it, how we're applying it, what does it do, and then we have some sense of there's a need. What's the need? You know, and sometimes we're driven to that question based on where we are geographically, certainly. What studio, what environment we're teaching in, you know, who's our audience, very specifically. I think we can be drawn to that specific question more or less. But it's also, I think, a bigger picture kind of question, right? Of how do we take this beautiful thing, this method, and we go, yes, and, right? Yes, it's well uh-huh. balanced right. and yes, you know, my mentor, my teacher, Carol Appel, used to always tell me, because I'm a, you know, not only almost defiantly curious, but also always looking for, like, if nothing is ever enough. So I have this kind of this desire to always know more, which I'm sure that you all can relate to, and you folks listening. But she would say to me, the method is enough. Like, if you just do it and you do it well and you do it with thoughtfulness and you do it consistently, it's enough. It's just enough. And I would say it's enough and it could be better, or we could do more, or we could customize it, or we could alter it, change it, modify it, which we do, I think. But and this certainly comes around to the conversation that Deborah and I would say we're having last time in our last episode, but have had frequently. And I would like to maybe just push it over to you, Deborah, to see what you're making of this in particular relating to the method being enough, and that moment of like questioning or discerning for oneself. Is it everything, or do we change it, or do we add to it? Or, you know, I think, Deborah, your perspective is unique too, because your history and exposure to Eve, who had a very different approach than what I would call the classic approach.
Not initially. I mean, she was trained one-on-one by Joseph Pilates.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what most people think of is, when they think of Eve, they think of when she was elderly,
yes,
down in Santa Fe.
Correct.
And doing
the,
you know, more her therapeutic healing work, which is when I met her too.
Yeah.
But when she was a younger woman and, you know, dancing professionally and choreographing in New York, I mean, she did the Pilates that Joseph Pilates taught her.
Right. As classic as it gets.
That's about as classic as it gets, yeah. Certainly there was an emphasis that a lot of us have backed away from, you know, the navel to spine, spine to mat instruction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm hesitating. I don't really want to get into a conversation around the flexion issue. I think it's a larger conversation, but in terms of maybe my own input regarding discernment, I think there was a point for me in teaching the Pilates method where a light went on. You know, there's a lot of quotes or things that are said about the method, or, you know, interpretations of what we think Joseph Pilates himself said, or what people who knew him said he said. I've contemplated these, trying to make sense of them for myself over many, many years. One of them being natural human movement. This is natural human movement. And I just sort of held that for all these years. And I know there was a certain point when I thought, okay, I really have to make sense of this for myself. And I just started to look at the method, look kind of through it, like through a lens or something, and make sense of it for myself, in the sense that all of the movements, the movement patterns, the exercises, if you will, are, if you distill them down, they're based on developmental movement patterning. And so for myself, what I chose to think is, how can I interpret all of this? How can I interpret this and help people get the movements back that they don't have anymore? So that, like, we're a human structure, we have this design, and when we respect that design and take it in as many different ways, when we utilize the function of our body as fully as possible, depending on our level of capability, you know, at any point in our life or any day of the week, then it works better for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have to understand what that design is. And then, so it's not about, to me, it's not whether, you know, flexion, less flexion, more extension, etc. It's more, what movements does this person still have well in their body, and what movements have they lost for whatever reason? Where are they held? Where are they braced? Where did they? Where have they stopped moving? Because wherever we've stopped moving, we're going to be, you know, lacking oxygenation and circulation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how I helped myself make sense of this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I know that it's very important to understand people's conditions and respect them. And I also tend to shy away from never do this, never do this. We can never do this because, you know, I'm not willing to go there.
Yeah. Yeah. I love what you're saying. And Julie in particular, knows that that is, my adamant perspective as well
I think that is like one of the things that, I mean, as a new teacher, you know, that kind of was the thing I was most afraid of,
mm-hmm.
you know, is making someone flex and have them like maybe break.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
So
you don't want to break anybody.
Yeah. You don't want to break anybody. So you kind of err on, you know, maybe the other side too much and
mm-hmm.
just, you know, kind of getting that breakthrough as a new teacher of, you know, where can I find the ease in this body and do it right and trust my own judgment that I'm seeing what I think I'm seeing and I'm making the right decision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we did talk.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes,
before
please.
We ask another question?
Please, yes.
I just want to follow up real briefly with this, which is Chantel and I have talked about this, so it's kind of a thread. We're all, whether we're in the practitioner, I think Pam talked about, she mentioned something about as a practitioner and then as a teacher, I think she's talking back and forth a little about her experience there. We're all of us always on a continuum of development.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we talk about working level or level of capability with regard to our students or some, you know, to know how far to push somebody or how much to support them and being able to recognize that level of capability so that we do things that are going to be beneficial to us and not harmful. And also for the mental part of it so that we're not overstraining the nervous system. And then that changes so that when you sort of go along for a while and then you're, let's just say, you've mastered this, right? So then you're ready to kind of slip into the next level, if you will, but then you're a beginner again. It's like when you start to tackle another level of complexity, you're actually you have to take a beginning approach again.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the same thing with us as teachers. We may feel very facile with our words and our cueing and our ability to modify and really see right through the method or the person's needs at a lesser level of complexity. And then as the movement patterns start to get more complex or what the person brings in, you know, what they present with is more complex, then we kind of are thrown back into a more beginner state of mind as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really important to acknowledge that, you know, the more complicated things people come to us with, yes, definitely we have to, you know, we have to give ourselves permission to back down for a while and be unsure and
yes.
have to study some more and yeah, so that, and definitely the longer you've been teaching, just the more people you've seen year after year after year, you build confidence because you've tried things and you know that that you can experiment and you know that you don't have to just follow a firm set of protocol.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, you follow the protocol. Of course you do.
Yes, of course you do. I think there are a lot of interesting things coming up. And one, I think, starting over, right? Starting again, you know, that Buddhist perspective of beginner's mind, of approaching something with, like, from a blank slate. I think that it's what happens when we become discerning. I think there are all of these moments where we decide, we have an aha, we have an epiphany, we have like a holy cow, you know, whether that's I mean, it's very often happening from because of the exposure to a complex situation or a body in front of us, and we're having to step back and really reorient and be able to step away from all the things that we know because the body is not responding in the way that we anticipate or, you know, hope. So I think that's a part of this process. And then something that you said, Deborah, makes me think like, because the next question really that we had kind of posed in our earlier conversation off camera, off recording is, is what if anything, can you identify as a catalyst for becoming more discerning? Like something you read, a teacher you've been exposed to, an idea, a complementary method. But I think it is also, what you said, Deborah, about, what did you say? Natural human movement.
Yeah, because I remember that's what they always said that it was.
Yeah. So that's, to me, that's a catalyst, right? It's like, I've been teaching all this time and I'm questioning. I know that there's a question, right? And you will often hear it's like, it's not the answer. It's not about the answer that you get. It's about framing or posing the right question, asking the right question. And to me, I think that too is, that's the catalyst for becoming more discerning. It's like, what does that mean? Natural human movement. What does that mean? And how do I move in that direction with the method or the tools that I have at hand? And I think that opens us up for greater discernment. And it is also a call to start again, to be willing to start from the beginning, to start fresh, right? We're having to change direction and perspective. And I think that's what has always drawn me to this work is that there's always a question. There's always a question, right? It's not just one answer. So then the question for you ladies, for Julie and Pam, would be what kinds of catalysts have there been for triggering discernment, for triggering questioning, can you identify any of those? And I'm going to ask a second part because I think this will probably take us maybe kind of full circle, which is what's your experience of yourself through this whole teaching journey of becoming a teacher to now, I think we're all just always becoming, what we are constantly. But do you feel like what level of curiosity or discernment did you bring in? Did you come in with, and what has developed over time, potentially related to, any number of catalysts? So I'm going to ask Julie if she'll take that one first.
Oh yeah, I mean, for me, it's so many things. I mean, I'm kind of like you, I guess. I just have this insatiable curiosity about everything, and because it's all so connected, in Pilates. I mean, the fascial system, which I knew nothing about until I started, doing teacher training,
mm-hmm.
And I would say that anatomy in general, just having been introduced to anatomy on a much deeper level as a teacher. And then finding that there were a lot of answers for me in my teaching in learning the anatomy. That, mm-hmm. Why do these bones, work this way? How does this muscle move this bone? It just became like, wow, I've been walking around in this body my whole life and I had no idea how it worked, and it's fascinating. It's mm-hmm. this incredible machine. And when I went to the family workshop in New York a couple of years ago, one of the instructors was an orthopedic surgeon, and he talked about the fact that synovial fluid, that it doesn't feel like anything else, and that it's just the most slippery liquid that, you know, he said, it's just, if the human body produces this stuff, and it's just this kind of magical stuff that, when you think about it, lasts your whole life. You know, I mean, you know what, you can't buy an appliance that lasts 100 years, you know, mm-hmm. and that you don't have to change the oil in or something. So, you know, it's just that I think I just had a much deeper understanding of how complex the body is and how all these things have to work together. And knowing how that complexity then made me want to find out more. And the more I found out, the more I realized how much I don't know. You know, it's this endless circle that leads me down all these different paths. And now, you know, now it's led me down this path to neuroplasticity and, you know, how does the brain, and working with this man who's a quadriplegic, you know, it's just been fascinating watching him progress. And then I would say the other things are just, you know, I make it a point to go to lots of different studios and hear lots of different teachers. And I always take something away from the cueing. You know, I'm often like thinking, wow, that was a great cue. And I suddenly feel that in a way that I haven't felt that before. Mm-hmm. And sometimes what I hear is something that I think, wow, I'll never say that. You know, that's a learning experience too. Mm-hmm. So,
great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Perfect. It's perfect. Totally answers the question. I'm going to, Deborah, if you want to, do you want to jump in for anything before Pam goes?
No, except to just corroborate. I think a lot of it was very helpful to me when I finally wrapped my mind around. I'd studied anatomy so much, in college, anatomy, kinesiology, many courses. Somehow it never stuck. I even took the clay building workshop, here in Boulder at the Boulder School of Massage when that guy first started building the clay on the skeleton and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it would, you know, it was lots of fun and everything. But honestly, I have to give credit to the training I did with Eric Franklin for really helping turn me around in terms of, I don't know, it was timing and just the way the workshops were taught gave me a much... it was sort of gave me confidence to study the body in a way that I hadn't had before. And I also felt like a lot of the kind of questions around what am I seeing changed and gave me confidence that I think is really very helpful to understand how the body works.
Mm-hmm. Pam, we're anxiously awaiting to hear what you have to say about curiosity and catalysts for questioning.
Just clarify the question one more time, Chantel.
Right. So what catalysts can you identify in your teaching that made you really think, oh, that's what that means. It clarifies an idea so that your teaching pivots or changes, your perspective changes, and you really start to manifest your own teaching uniqueness, right? Your own unique perspective rather than, right, that moves us away from just all the rote, repetitive framework that we've been given, which is what Deborah has pointed out is so critical in those early stages of learning, right? Mimicry is so critical. But if you can identify any specific catalysts or ideas that mm-hmm. have moved you forward into a different layer of your teaching?
I think a couple, I'll be very specific, but initially I think one of the themes is opposition. I've always been fascinated with opposition. And when I realized kind of seeing how the push-pull or how one side of the body needs to stabilize while the other side moves or one part of the body needs to stabilize so that opposite part can move, that's when I started thinking, okay, there's something inside that I need to learn more about. And so then I started digging deeper through workshops and, you know, figuring out how to apply this movement into my own life and realizing that we have two different bodies, essentially, in one. I mean, and that's the thing that I always thought was interesting is the oppositional work that this movement can help bring us back to symmetry. I mean, ideally, mm-hmm. symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on is, you know, seeing that and applying that not only just in my life, but to the other lives that I interact with every day, that's probably one of the biggest things that has sort of pushed me and wanting to dig deeper. And then having to teach that or having to help somebody understand that. The other thing is, and I so appreciate Deborah saying this, and I never really thought about this, but the four stages of competence. I always think about that is, you know, that even as an instructor and as well as the person who's receiving, you both are kind of going through these levels of competency. And I never really thought about that. And I think, but to me, I'm always fascinated how the brain has to organize itself in order to understand a movement and then to apply it, you know, in that unconscious competence way, you know, mm-hmm. like the level that it has to go with. So I love how the brain works, and that's the part where I am at right now. Is like, ooh, let me. I need to figure out how this works and how to increase my knowledge of that, so that I can, you know, teach that.
Mm-hmm.
Because the neuroplasticity is exactly what I'm fascinated about. What Julie was saying, and
mm-hmm.
I think it is much deeper than just this movement. It's just more the understanding of why we move. So. You know, I don't know if that's, and then the right brain, and the left brain, that's, I mean, there is opposition going on up there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of what has sort of sparked my curiosity to continue
mm-hmm.
moving in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the curiosity, right, the going deeper, mm-hmm. the greater understanding, I think, then goes hand in hand with we requires us to be more discerning, right? We have kind of more bandwidth for discerning because we have more information. We have, you know, we know that there's more to it than just that basic framework. What do you think, Deborah? What do you have? Any thoughts so far?
This is great.
It is great.
I'm just like, I have a whole page of notes on a piece of paper that I need for something else. But
so there was one thing I think that was kind of an example of discernment that I was kind of curious about coming back around to, which is this idea of placing the body, right? Like arranging the body and then moving, like this level of discernment where we start to think of like, do we always need to put the body in a position and then move? Or like, what is that? What kind of priority is that indicative of versus just move and let's see what happens. And then we'll adjust as we go, and what kind of priority is that indicative of? And what else I'll say is that I think when we talk about priorities in our teaching, what it leads us to discover or question is why we're teaching. And both of the ladies have touched on this in the beginning, and it is a pivotal part of the work that we're doing in the mentoring program. Really understanding or clarifying for ourselves, you know, what motivates us to teach? Why are we teaching? What are we hoping to achieve? You know, what's our purpose in our craft, in our vocation of teaching? Which I think you're right, Deborah, is potentially part two of this conversation, which is essentially the macro view, that larger, you know, that larger intent. But let's wrap up with just talking about this specific example of if you arrange the body first and then get it to move. What's that like? What's that like? What's that about? I'm curious, Deborah, to hear your point of view, because it sounded like you felt pretty strongly that they were different things.
Well, I have a couple of thought lines. I know that when I'm in the teacher training situation and I'm observing my students and they're, practice teaching with me, etc., I really work hard to eliminate as much as possible the phrase, before you even move, ... because that just somehow seems antithetical to me.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, people need guidance.
Yes.
And, so how much, how little, where, you can't just, you don't have to say, okay, lie down and go. Because that's not fair. We're not talking about, expressive dance here. We're not talking about improv. We're not doing improv.
Right.
We are teaching a form.
Mm-hmm.
And the form has incredible beauty, benefit, logic. Again, I've spent many years discerning for myself what I think the logic of the method is.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had to have a point of view to teach it. So, I think there's a distinction between, you can't box somebody into this alignment and then get them so tense about whether they're doing it right. See, that's where we got to watch out, I think.
Right.
Enough setup, enough of what we call the nuts and bolts to get them beginning to be organized.
Mm-hmm.
And then try to get a flow going. And then part of, our task is to get more facile at teaching through the transitions so that we're actually modeling that these movement patterns that we teach are truly patterns. They're not exercise to exercise to exercise, and that even within, let's say, the footwork, there's a distinction. We're not doing 10 repetitions of the same movement. That our philosophy is that each time you go, it's new.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but people can't pay attention to that many things at the beginning. It's just mm-hmm. too much. So I think part of our job as the teacher is to help them hone in on a few thoughts, just enough to get going. And then as they get more and more familiar with the pattern, then we can layer in more information. It's not mm-hmm. helpful to overcorrect, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We all know that. It just gets everybody all balled up.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the word arrange, though. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
it's beautiful in a way, right? You arrange yourself. I think, too, of words like gathering yourself up. And, you have to come there. We have to arrive. We're actually, you and I talked about this, probably one of our very first podcasts, I think, Chantal, about the whole lesson as a metaphor for being able to have in our crazy world an experience of completion, like a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
Especially we talked about it relative to having little kids and feeling like you never get your sentence finished. Your life is constantly being interrupted, and all those ways that we're interrupted and we never feel that completion, that resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that a Pilates lesson can actually be a model of that for somebody's nervous system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think part of what we do as teachers is provide structure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. of course.
And there's that other thing where we get so hung up on setting it up. And then, oh, wait a second, before you even move,
yeah,
make sure you la-di-da-di-da. You know,
right.
So that kind of, to me, exemplifies this icky thing that we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting to me because, you know, I think we can oscillate back and forth, right? Between, more set up or less set up and more kind of just let's move and work into the flow and let's see what the pattern is and let's correct and adjust and experiencing, you know, the pattern, through movement, because that's what ultimately we're taking with us, right? We're walking out of the studio. We're getting in our car. We're moving throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And
each situation is a different intention. I mean, this is why I think what you're saying, like you said, it brings it all back around, and maybe it is more macro. Is our intention to get it right? Is our intention
yes.
to find comfortability in our body? Is our intention to realize that we hold our breath all the time? Is our intention to... whatever, there's so many things that could be your intention that day that will guide you
yes.
as to how much instruction, how much not instruction, how much openness.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. Yeah, because it does change our priorities, right? If we're very, if we get stuck in these beginning stages of learning, if we relate it to the four levels of learning, you know, unconscious, incompetence, et cetera, we can get, as teachers, I mean, you know, we can get stuck and then therefore get our students stuck in those, you know, really that second level of conscious incompetence, where it's like the teacher dictating the setup because the priority is form. The priority is form. The priority is perfection. The priority is like, get the choreography right. And I think to some degree, we all get caught up in that a little bit. At different stages in our teaching, and of course, it varies greatly from person to person. But I think it's not difficult or uncommon to be very stuck in that, right? Like we set the exercise up, we get them all arranged and aligned, and then okay, now inhale and press out, exhale and pull in. It's very formulaic, right? Where maybe even the unconscious priority is like get it right. Set them up right, symmetry, alignment, dare I say perfection, although I don't know that any of us are really searching for that in the client, but maybe in ourselves we're searching for that, as opposed to a little less set up and a little more intention and priority on the experience of function informing form and the exploration of movement or any of the other, you know, thousands of things that we could put our intention on. And I think that's the result. Let's see, is it the result of discernment or I think being clear about our intention and priority is the result of discernment, which is the product of curiosity. Does that make sense to you guys?
Can you send me that in an email?
Yeah. So it goes like this, right? So something is the catalyst for our curiosity. Right, something doesn't work. Something hurts a client, like
right,
ow, they
right,
have
right.
pain.
What's the motivation? Why aren't you just okay?
Yeah, there's a question,
yeah.
right? And then
yeah.
the question gets us to go, oh, I'm going to change my teaching, and I'm going to do this instead of, I'm going to do B instead of A. Right, that's discernment, and then our discernment leads us closer to oh. I'm going to choose B instead of A because I feel like this is more important than this, right? That's prioritizing, that's creating a priority or creating an intention. And then that process is infinite, right? That process just goes on and on and on.
I think that also, though, you have to have something to compare and contrast in order to become discerning.
Yeah. And you mean specifically working within...
Well, I'm just thinking, like, how does one become discerning? You got to have Pam's opposition stuff. You know, you have to... It's like paying attention. Yeah, but I wonder. I'm not even sure.
Can I
don't think it's like an order. I don't know if it's like a perfect order.
Yeah, right. No, of course not. Yeah, of course not. Go ahead, Pam.
Well, and that, I think about, like, life, right? We have morals and values, and we decide to do certain things because and based on those. So in a sense, in Pilates, we decide to do certain movements or we teach a certain way or we believe a certain way because of what you were saying. I think, and I don't want to say standards, but there has to be a spine to all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there has
mm-hmm.
to be a foundation of where this all comes and flourishes from. So if you have, you know, something that I would say, I don't like a law, you know, from that, okay, well then this is the reasons why we do all these certain things. And I just feel like you do have to have a base. You do have to have a spine. You do have to have something to come off of the reasons why we teach or why we do what we do. And I think it ebbs and flows. But there's always going to be that standard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm cautious about using that word. But I do know, and just my, you know, just tiny little observation of kind of globally what's going on from a Pilates perspective is that I really think there is somewhat of a push and will always be this willingness or this idea of having there some kind of standardization because, I mean, we want that. We want to be recognized for this work. And I think that's what Joseph Pilates tried to do a long time ago. And it was, sadly, not recognized. And Deborah, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I just feel like that's been kind of missed because even physical therapists, people who go to formal education are complementary of our work. And that's why I like, this is real stuff. We have this knowledge, we have this standard, and it works, you know, and then we have a blank canvas that walks through our door every day, and we have to be able to create something of that because of the way that person's moving or the way the person's feeling that day or that injury that they've had to deal with for the past 20 years of their life.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
Well, I think you're talking about contrast. I think you're both talking about contrast, right? You have to have something to compare it to.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like there's a quote about a blind man will never know the darkness because he has no experience of light. Like there's no
mm-hmm.
sense that, you know,
right.
that blindness is darkness because there's no oppositional experience. So
mm-hmm.
I think of course and again, I've used this example so frequently, I'm kind of tired of hearing myself say it, but as a writer, we have a framework, we have rules, we have grammar, we have punctuation, we have, you know, you have to work within the rules for a very, very long time until you start to see that the rules don't facilitate the emotion or the message, right, that you're trying to get across, and so you break the rules. So I think maybe that's kind of what we're talking about, and I think this is definitely leads us into, like, we need to have a part two. So we need to have part two. And we all need to you know, honor each other's time. And I want to do that. We're a little long, but such a valuable and beautiful, sweet conversation. And I just really, really appreciate you both, Pam and Julie, for spending the time with us. And Deborah, of course, you always such insightful wisdom.
I like having the other people.
Yes.
It's really fun.
It's great. It's great. So hopefully if you're listening to this podcast, you'll be inspired to reach out to myself or to Deborah and get yourself on the other end of this conversation. So, I think, ladies, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you again so much for spending some time with us, and we will talk to everybody next time around.
Thank you. Thanks
okay.
for having me.
Thanks, Julie.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Deborah. Thanks, Pam. All right. Good night, y'all.
Thank you. Good night.
Want to hear between your ears and swim inside your brain. Oh.